to compute the Green's functions or the Bergedorf perturbation theory. They are given by a sum of Feynman diagrams. However, it's not immediately clear how to use this to compute, say, probabilities of particle scattering. So let me formulate Feynman rules for quantities that are directly observable. So today we'll study amplitudes, S matrix, and then various probabilities of decay rates and scattering cross section. So the object that we want to study, so that this setting, typical setting, is that we have two particles that collide, then they interact and they can scatter or they can create some other particles. And we want to compute the probability of this process. So usually in many situations, the time duration of this process can be considered infinite. So for instance, if people, if we consider a particle experiments on accelerators when they collide beams of particles, of course the size of the accelerator is much larger than the typical interaction scales between elementary particles. And the time scales involved in these collisions are also much, much larger than the time scales in the microscopic world of elementary particles. So the operator that describes the evolution in infinite time is called the S matrix. So it is appropriate in these situations where we have huge separation of time scales, so that there is an interaction scale which takes place, which are basically instantaneous or have a scale of a very short time. And then there is a laboratory scale which is very large, so we just take it to infinity. And we want to consider the amplitude that so that we have the initial state and final state, and we want to evolve this in time. So we start with the initial state, then evolve it. This time evolution operator, and then take the limit when time goes to infinity. So this operator is called the S matrix. Now the question will be how to compute the matrix elements of the S matrix in field theory, where initial and final states are states in the Fock space. So they are states containing, say, M and N particles. Actually, it's more natural to write out as a bra vector. So then So then this amplitude describes a process when we have n particles coming in. Then something happens. They collide, interact a certain way, and they produce m outgoing particles. Yes, thank you. So how to calculate the probability of this process? So the probability is the square of the amplitude. So how to compute the amplitude? The answer is that we can use the same interaction representation in which our particles and fields are treated as free fields. However, we take into account interaction by some unitary transformation from interaction representation to the Heisenberg representation. Anyway, so the answer is one can easily guess that we have to sandwich this unitary operator that's represented by the T matrix. And then one normalizes that on the vacuum transition amplitude. So, so this can be computed. Yes.
Should that be the numerator?
Yes. And then we can expand in perturbation. So expand these exponentials. Power series, and everything would reduce to correlation functions of some number of oscillators, because these in and out states are created by oscillator operators, and so we can compute them using Weak's theorem. So the only new ingredient here is that we need to find a contraction of the field that that arises from the expansion of the evolution operator with the field in the in and out states. So suppose that we have some phi of x somewhere from the vertex, from the interaction vertex here. And then we want to find what is the contraction of x with the particle in the initial state. So what does it mean? So phi of x contains positive and negative frequency parts. And so we want to commute all the annihilation operators in phi to the right. And then this initial state is created by some number of creation operators. So we should commute phi plus through this creation operators to the right, and then they annihilate the empty state. So in the process, we'll pick up a commutator of phi with the creation operator of this particular particle. And so this would this defines a parity. Now, phi plus, I remind you that this is equal to, so here it's convenient to use the three-dimensional representation, three-dimensional momentum integral. ak to the minus I k x. Oh, it's a separation, right. So this commutator of ak with a dagger p is the delta function. And then you see that, so this normalization factors cancel. The integral is eaten by the delta function. And so what remains is simply the this plane wave exponential. So this is equal to e to the minus ipx. And quite similarly, the contraction with the out state . So here, of course, we assume that this is on shell. So P0 here is equal to the on shell energy. So similarly, this is equal to the e to the IPX. So this is just the wave function of the initial particle or the final particle. Conveniently, when we go into the momentum space, so if you do the Fourier transform, this factor simply disappears. So it's used in for Fourier expansion that we apply for the internal part of the Feynman diagrams. So Feynman rules for amplitudes are the same as for the Green's functions, with the only difference that on the external lines, so the factors that associated with external lines are just equal to one, right? So this external line was not, it's just a particle, it leaves its wave function, then we do Fourier transform, it disappears. There is no propagator associated to the external line. Moreover, we should not take into account corrections to the external lines. So Feynman rules for amplitudes they are more or less the same as for Green's functions. With the only two differences. So the first difference is that no propagators on external line. We shouldn't take into account corrections, no corrections to external lines. And also, the diagrams should be connected. So let me illustrate what kind of diagrams do we need. So let's consider some examples. So for instance, this diagram will describe 2-2-2 scattering in the 5-4 theory. And the amplitude associated with this diagram is just minus I to the lambda. So for the Green's functions, if you remember, we also had propagators for each of the external lines. But here the external lines correspond to particles. In the X representation, they would be associated with the wave functions. When we do the Fourier transform, we are left with nothing. And also, we should multiply by the total energy conservation of the function. So these are initial momenta. Then the momenta should be conserved. So this is the lowest order diagram that contributes to the 2-2-2 scattering. So as a second example, we may consider loop corrections to this process. And then, okay, so this diagram, for instance, that we found as a correction to, as we would found as a correction to the Green's functions here, should be not taken into account. So this diagram should be dropped. The reason for that is that this diagram it modifies the properties of a single particle. So it modifies its mass, its wave function, but it doesn't modify the interactions of this particle with other particles. And this is something that we don't take into account here, because we have created the in and out states just with oscillators. But oscillator states are no longer eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And in fact, this type of diagrams, they precisely take into account the corrections to external states. So they correct, okay, the particles become dressed with interactions precisely by corrections into external lines. So if you want to study the scattering of physical particles with this dressing taken into account, we should simply drop these corrections. Yes?
Tell the difference between those two diagrams.
the difference, well, let me maybe draw another diagram. So this diagram is three diagrams and loops. Maybe it's better to compare this two. You see that I cannot eliminate. So by cutting this line here, I can divide this diagram into pieces. So if I cut it here, then there will be an external line that's corrected. Whereas this diagram is, if I cut it anywhere, I cannot separate external line and corrected. So it's really this diagram describes correctness into scattering, but not into. So this should be dropped and this should be yes.
If there were one of those loopy things on one of the internal lines of the bottom diagram, would you have to take that into account?
Like
Like that?
Yes.
This should be kept also, because again, this is the correction to the internal line. So it's, this is a virtual particle which mediates interactions, but it's not a correction to the external state. So what should be drawn are diagrams of this type. So there is some some interaction block, and then there is a scattering. In general, this should be drawn. So one should take into account the diagrams of this type. Now, so the third example is okay. Suppose that we study three to three process, and then let's compare this diagram. So this is one particles 1, 2, 3. Going into particles 1 prime, 2 prime, 3 prime. And I don't know. Let's see. And this diagram. One, two, three. So this shouldn't be taken into account. So we should drop this diagram. And this should be kept. So the difference here is that this describes an irreducible process of scattering of all three particles participate. So here, the third particle is a spectator. Nothing happens to it. It only one and two scatter. So this is a. This shouldn't be taken into account as a genuine three-to-three process. So when we compute the three-to-three amplitude, only this diagram should be taken into account. Okay, so. Suppose now that we computed our amplitudes to the desired accuracy, then we need to calculate probabilities. So let me describe how to do it and what do these probabilities mean in the two most important cases, namely of particle decay and scattering. So let's start with discussing a one-to-n process. So we have one initial particles, and then some number of particles in the final state. So this is described by diagrams where we start with one particle. Then we draw all possible diagrams with one particle, one line coming in, and n lines going out. So obviously, this amplitude describes a decay of a particle. So if we have an unstable particle, it can decay and produce some final state that contains some
number of particles larger than one. We can compute in principle the amplitude of this process by calculating the diagrams, and as here, we will always get this energy conservation factor. So it's convenient to take it out and calculate. First of all, let's make another step. So the S matrix can be expanded in, so we can extract the unit operator from the S matrix, which is a no scattering term. So, right, that if there are no interactions, the S matrix would be equal to 1. So, nothing would happen to initial states. They would go to the same state after evolution the infinite amount of time. So what we are really computing when we do diagrams are the matrix elements of the T. So suppose that we computed this matrix element, and then it will have the general form of energy momentum conserving delta function. Multiplied by some function of kinematical variables, of external momentum. So then we should take the square of, so to compute the probability, we take the amplitude, square it, and integrate over available phase space. So what is the, or sum over all possible states that we are interested in. So to understand what is the measure in the phase space of n particles, we need to remember that the one particle states are normalized in this way. So because of relativistic normal invariance, we have introduced this factor in the normalization of the state. So the completeness condition of particle states actually reads like that. So there is an extra factor of energy here. Therefore, the probability, the differential probability, to produce this particle with given momenta is given by basically by the amplitude squared, but so the measure should be normalized in an appropriate way. And then we should take the amplitude squared and divide it by the normalization of the wave function of the initial particle. Okay? So this factor comes from, so this is a differential probability. It's probability normalized to the element in the phase space. So it's probability to produce particles with given momenta normalized to the volume of their possible to differentials of their momentum. So this comes from the normalization of the wave functions. And so we need to compute the ratio of two matrix elements, which basically is infinite. The reason is that we have a delta function here. And so when we square a delta function, we get infinity. It's not, the square of the delta function is not a distribution. However, because in whatever multiplies a delta function, we can replace the argument by zero, and so this will be delta of momentum conservation times delta of zero. But now delta of zero, we know what it is. It's just the volume of four space, so 2π/4 delta of zero is equal to product of three volume and the interval of time. So
tell us what the difference. This is t. This is time.
This is time.
And what is m?
What is
m?
M. Where is m? Oh, m here. So I have rules to compute this matrix element. So m. This is the definition of m. For instance, here in this example, m would be minus I lambda. Because this delta function will go at present in all the diagrams. If I compute this diagram, there will be also an overall delta function, so it's convenient to take it out of the matrix element. Now this T, yes, so this is volume of space, and this is duration of time. I don't know how to see. Maybe I should write a small t for it, not to confuse it with the t operator. Also, part of this infinity is cancelled by the normalization to the norm of the wave function of the initial particle. Because that's also infinite.
I don't see how we get that physical interpretation out.
This formula?
Yes.
So let's see. There is the formula of this type. So it's a great. Delta function of four momentum. So zero here is four momentum. We integrate it over, so if you integrate over the whole space, the plane wave, then we get the delta function of four momentum. And then we can set p equals to zero formally. So on the left hand side, we'll get delta of zero. And on the right hand side, we'll get the integral over four-dimensional space, which is three volume times time interval. So if we now compute the normalization of the one particle wave function,
that's equal to 2 times the energy of this particle. And then we have two oscillators. So we need to interchange their order. And then this will be just a commutator. And then the vacuum, the norm of the vacuum state, which is 1. So this is equal to 2 pi cubed. And again, delta function of 0. But now this is a 3D delta function. So we should interpret this as a volume of space. So the factor of volume actually cancels between numerator and denominator. The factor of time doesn't cancel, so the probability will grow linearly with time, but which is more or less expected, because the physical meaning that has only the probability in unit time. So the finite quantity is the probability normalized to unit time. So if you have some particle, certainly the total probability of its decay will be proportional to the time that we wait. So if we wait 10 days, it will have 10 times more probability to decay. So the finite quantity, independent of, that depends only on the properties of the particle, is the probability of decay in unit time, which is called the decay width. And denoted by gamma. So if we divide the probability by this time interval, then we get the decay width, the differential decay width, which we can write as the differential of phase space. And then there we will have a ratio of squared matrix element divided by twice the mass of the particle. So this is in the rest frame, in the particle's rest frame. So 2m is basically this factor, so the rest energy. So the square of the reduced matrix elements is comes from squaring the amplitude. And then the rest is just the available phase space. So d phi. Is equal to product over differentials of moment of all particles. Normalized in some particular way. Times the momentum and energy conserving delta function. So this is the main result. It tells us so how to calculate the probability of particle decay in unit time inside the unit element of the phase space. So let me make a few remarks. So first of all, the phase space is Lorentz invariant. Which is basically due to that factor. So this can be written as a four-dimensional integral times the delta function. And so this normalization makes the differential of three-momentum Lorentz invariant. This delta function is also Lorentz invariant. So the dimensionality of the phase space is so n particle phase space is 3 times p, 3 times n minus 4 dimensional. So, for instance, if we consider two particle decays, then n is equal to 2. So the phase space is just two-dimensional, which is easy to understand. So this in the rest frame, so suppose these are identical particles. So by momentum conservation, they will fly apart with equal momenta. And the absolute value of momenta is fixed by energy conservation, right? So the phase space in this case is just the unit sphere because they can fly in arbitrary direction, right? So the parameters are basically angle, so two angular coordinates in which direction one of the particles flies. So and this follows from here. So there are three n possible momenta of particles, but they're constrained by energy conservation and momentum conservation. So, that's a different. This is dimension. This is not dimension. It's dimensionality.
Yeah.
The number of parameters. Number of parameters that characterize this reaction when we take into account the possible conservation conditions. So anyway, so in this formula, this formula is just kinematics. It doesn't depend on, it's simply it's the same for any particle decay. So what is model specific is this matrix element. So that when we have one particular, so we have some field theory, we can, in principle, compute this amplitude by doing Feynman diagrams. And then this formula allows us to compute the probability of particle decay. So this is the differential probability. It's probability for particles to decay into a given particular state. That's not forbidden by conservation laws. So many times we are interested in the total probability of decay. So that's obtained by integrating over the phase space and summing over all possible channels. So the partial decay rate associated with any particular final state is an integral over whole phase space of the differential width, and then the total width is the sum over all decay channels of their partial widths So the meaning of this quantity is that it determines the average lifetime of particles. So, of course, in quantum mechanics, everything is probability. So if you have an unstable particle, it may live 1 second, but it may live 2 seconds. So there is, we can only compute probabilities of that. So the total, the width determines the average probability. And so it will determine the average lifetime. So by, now if you count dimension in the sense that you mentioned, so it's clear that probability is dimensionless. And so the width has the dimension of inverse time. So the inverse of the width is the particle mean lifetime. So this is the mean lifetime of the particle. So now, why is it called the width? Well, the reason is that many particles in that we know are so unstable that they are not observed directly. So they don't make they live too short to leave any traces of their existence. So what happens is that when one considers the collision of two particles, typical setup of accelerator experiments, and measures probability of something happening in the collision, the probability has a peak at certain energy. So at this peak is corresponds to the resonance associated with the production of an unstable particle. So we collide two particles. They make some unstable particle, and then it decays very quickly. But the probability of this process, of process 2 going to n particles, is enhanced because there is an intermediate state that is a particle that's unstable, but it's still a one particle state. So the position of this peak is determined by the mass of the particle, and the width of the peak is determined by its lifetime. But so it's literally the width is the average width of this resonance curve. So this this resonance is described typically by Breit-Wigner formula, and so the width of the resonance is determined by the mean lifetime of the particle, so this is typically the way to measure the lifetime, is just to measure the width of the resonance. Yes?
X axis is
energy.
So total energy that goes here. So total energy of the particle is called center of mass energy of collision. And this is some measure actually number of events of this type. Normalizing something.
So now let's consider the next case of 2 to the n. Processes, so we'll study scattering cross-section. So now we consider the process of two particles colliding and producing some n particle final state. So as we saw, the natural quantity that characterizes the decays of a particle has dimension of time. This is basically the mean lifetime of the particle, or its width, which is the inverse of that. It turns out that if you consider collisions of two particles, the natural quantity that characterizes the probability of collision has dimension of area, and it's called the cross section. Let me try to justify it using a very simple-minded model from classical physics, if you wish. So let's consider some toy model where we have a collision of two types of particles. So we have a beam of particles of type A. So we have collisions of A particles with B particles. And let's assume that A particles have, so they form a beam, so they flow in a continuous distribution with certain density, with certain velocity, and B particles are static and distributed in space in some random way. Okay. So let's also assume that A particles are point-like, or very small compared to the B particles, and that they're distributed uniformly in this cross-section of the beam. And the B particles are static, and they have, so we approximate them as round spheres of radius r. So these are point-like. And these are rigid spheres of radius r. So then it's clear how many particles. So suppose that this beam passes through the B particles, and we would like to know how many particles will experience the collision. Well, that's easy to understand. So what will happen is that each of these particles will drill a hole in this beam, right? So if you project it into the plane perpendicular to the beam, then all the particles that fall into this projection will collide with the B particle, and those that don't appear in these projected spots, they will pass through that collision. Okay. So the total number of collisions will be equal to well, total number of particles. So this would be so it will be proportional to the number of A particles, so because they are uniformly distributed. And so the fraction of A particles that experience the collision is equal to the ratio of the shaded area to the total area of the beam, right? So the shaded area is basically the area of the cross section of each of these rigid spheres multiplied by the number of them and divided by the area of the cross section of the beam. So A is the total area. And sigma here is just P R squared. Okay, so now let's write this in a way that makes this formula universal. Actually, it will, this formula, if written in some particular way, remains true for any collisions of not necessarily of this simple-minded classical picture, but of arbitrary particles. So let's divide. Let's say that our beam has a finite duration. So let's say that the duration of the beam of the pulse. So this beam has a form of a short pulse of duration t. And let's say that VA is the velocity of A particles. Then the longitudinal extent of the beam will be equal to basically VA times T. Right? So the beam will be fill some finite volume, which is a cylinder of length L and cross section A. Right? So the volume will be equal to VAT times A. So in particular, if we form the ratio of NA, of the number of A particles to the cross section, we can multiply that by VT, and that will be equal to the ratio of the number of particles times V times T divided by the volume. And so the number of particles divided by the volume is their number density, right? So then in this setup, when we have this beam, so incident pulse of some duration that collides with some distribution of B particles, it makes sense to talk about the number of collisions per unit volume per unit time. If you form this ratio, Then, okay, so n divided by a we replace by nvt. Then nb divided by volume is the number density of the b particles. And finally, so t cancels out. So we find that the number of collisions per unit volume per unit time is proportional to the velocity of A particles, to the number densities of A and B particles, which is the expected result. Of course, the larger is the density of particles, the more collisions we have, will have. So the velocity also, I mean, sure enough, the number of collisions linearly grows with velocity, because if A particles move very fast, they will collide more frequently. And now the coefficient here is basically it's in this toy model, it's just the cross section of B particles perpendicular to the incident direction of A particles. Now, in general, this formula will be always true. So this formula, although we derived in this very simple classical setup, it is always true. And so the statement here is that the number of collisions per unit volume per unit time is proportional to the number densities and to the velocity of A particles, with some coefficient of proportionality which has the dimensions of area. So this coefficient in the general setup is called the effective cross-section of the reaction. And its physical meaning is basically how much area is shaded up by one particle when we send another particle that collides with it. So sigma is the effective cross-section of the reaction. Notice here that we didn't specify what happened after the collision. So in principle, this arguments would have been true even if, I don't know, in each collision the A particle would smash completely the B particle, it will decay into pieces. That simply didn't matter. This formula simply counts how many times the collisions will happen. And so this is applicable to any reactions with arbitrary final states, but in the case where in the initial state we have two particles. So when we compute the quantum mechanical amplitude, then what basically the physical quantity that characterizes the probabilities reaction is this cross section. So we should be able to figure out how to get from the amplitude to the cross section. Yes.
This cross section, this is a good question. It should not be, right? Because it multiplies velocity is not Lorentz invariant. But on the left hand side, we have a Lorentz invariant quantity. So there is a way to define this product in such a way that sigma is Lorentz invariant. So I'll give the definition that is Lorentz invariant. But one has to keep in mind that basically what one makes Lorentz invariant is this product sigma times V. So from here it's absolutely not clear that it's Lorentz invariant. Well, so let me make another remark that this cross-section plays important, the notion of cross-section plays an important role in many areas of physics. Particle physics would experiment with measure on one thing that they measure on particle accelerators is precisely cross-sections of various reactions. So that tell us what is the characterized interaction among the elementary particles. But also it's a basic very quantity of that underlies the kinetic theory. So in kinetic theory, for instance, the if you are talking about some gas or fluid, the interactions there are characterized by the mean free path or molecule of a gas. The length of the mean free path is simply related by the cross section by it's inversely proportional to the cross section of collisions between molecules of the gas and the density. Okay. So so let's see how to compute the cross section from the amplitude. So the probability then, the probability of reaction, this, from this formula, we see that this is the probability is basically the number of collisions. Divided by an A and B. So this is probability relative to one elementary act of collision. So when we concentrate on two particles, right? So then when we consider one particular particle from the beam and one particular particle in the target, the probability of them to collide would be the total number of collisions divided by an A and B. And that we can write as sigma times the relative velocity. Okay, so in the toy model, we consider the situation when one particles were static and the other were colliding with them. We may think of a more general situation where both particles are moving. So for instance, we could have considered collisions in the center of mass frame, where they are total, so they collide such that their center of mass doesn't move. Anyway, so it's convenient to write it through relative velocity, and then there will be, so that would be proportional to the time interval divided by volume. Right, so we expect that when we compute this probability by squaring the matrix element, the volume will come out in the denominator. And this is what happens. So differential probability, this will be equal to the the measure in the phase space, and then the ratio of the amplitude squared. Divided by normalization of the wave functions. Okay, so again, this we can write as the delta function times the reduced matrix element.
So this denominator will be proportional to the volume times t, right? Because we square the delta function. In the numerator, we will have twice, two times we will have the, the volume will appear twice, because each of these wave functions is normalized to volume, to the volume, right? So indeed, we see that it is proportional to t divided by v. And so comparing with this formula, we see that the differential cross-section times the relative velocity is what remains here after we cross this infinite factors of volume. So at the end, we can write, collecting the rest of the finite pieces together, we can say that the differential cross section is equal to so d sigma will be equal to what? To d phi. So this is the phase volume of the final state. It's the same as in the calculation of the k width. Then there will be the matrix element squared, the reduced matrix element squared, which doesn't contain the delta function anymore. And then, so we should keep in mind that these guys are normalized in a relativistically invariant way, which produces a factor of 2e for each. So we'll have 4. Then we should divide by relative velocity and times ea, eb. Okay, so now returning to your question about relativistic invariance. So d phi is relativistic invariant. The matrix element is relativistic invariant. By the way, we derived this formula. This makes sense in the rest frame of B particles. So their relative velocity is simply the velocity of the particles that move, of the impact beam. But we can just define, so we can define in arbitrary reference frame. So this is in the rest frame of B. So in arbitrary rest frame, we can define relative velocity as in the following way. So it's k a dot kb squared. So these are four vectors minus ma squared minus mb squared. So one can check that this is this indeed coincides with the definition of velocity in the rest frame. I have no time to do it, but it's a very simple exercise. And it defines the relative velocity of an arbitrary reference frame. So, for instance, in if k A and KB are collinear, then with this definition, we find that relative velocity is equal to absolute value of KA d divided by EA minus KB divided by EB. And so this is indeed, this ratio is just the velocity of a relativistic particle. And so this is indeed relative velocity is the absolute value of the difference. But this is only when KA is parallel to KB. In more general reference framework is to use this formula. But one very rarely needs it. So usually collisions are considered in the frame where the collision particles moves along the collision axis. So anyway, so one can give a definition of the invariant cross section which is equal to the ratio of amplitude squared divided by this kinematic factor Ka dot Kb squared minus M A squared M B squared. And then there is the measure factor for the phase volume. So then to find the full cross section, one obviously integrates this over the phase space. So thank you. That's it for today. Yes.
The probability is dimensional.
No, when it's written in the differential form, the big E. No, it be not
here? Yes, this probability must be dimensionless.
How is it?
Well, one has to. This
is the inner product between states as units.
It does. Yeah, I guess it does because. We normalized our wave functions such that the scalar product has units. For instance, the norm of the state, we calculated it, this is equal to 2p times the volume of space, and this obviously has units. So this all of this has units and comes at the end correctly, at the end the property should be dimensionless. So here dimensions in this formula, the symmetric one can see that this is as dimensionless.